From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, as Republicans debate the proposed replacement for the ACA, a Democrat explains why she thinks it shouldn't be replaced at all.
Later, the state takes up a proposal to ease regulations on high-capacity wells, which some believe would lead to problems in the state's central sands.
When you water the crops, much of that water is held in the crops, and much of that water goes out through the leaves in evaporation. So a very small percentage actually goes into the ground to recharge the groundwater. So it is a blessing curse in terms of our sandy soil.
We'll get the story behind a remarkable conversation between eight Milwaukee chefs.
And one of the lesser-known ways Mozart's Don Giovanni broke the mold.
It's the first time in opera history where any composer had written for three male voices, low voices, to sing together at once.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, Republican politicians have vowed to repeal and replace the landmark legislation, also known as Obamacare.
They announced their plan last week. It's called the American Health Care Act, or Trump Care, and it's found critics on both sides of the aisle. Some have referred to it as Obamacare Lite, while others say it fails to protect the nation's most vulnerable people.
A report out this week from the Congressional Budget Office found that the bill would leave 24 million people without care over the next decade.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin has been a public advocate for health care reform for nearly two decades. She's already come out strongly against the new bill. The Democrat spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about why health care is such an important issue to her.
My reason for getting service many, many years ago was seeing way too many Americans left behind by our health care system. And as somebody who was uninsured in my childhood because of a pre-existing health condition, this is a battle that I've taken on for many years. We've made steps forward with health reforms, including the Affordable Care Act, and now President Trump, who on the campaign trail promised insurance for everybody, is breaking that promise, putting millions of people at risk of losing their health care coverage, and also in this plan, this Trump Care plan, forcing millions to pay more for less care.
So you said that you had a pre-existing condition as a child, which kept you from getting health care even though you were a kid. What was that pre-existing condition?
You know, I had a serious childhood illness at age 9. It was similar to spinal meningitis. It was not exactly that diagnosis, but it put me in the hospital for 3 months. And despite the fact that I fully recovered, my grandparents who raised me were unable to get insurance at any price because I had had this previous illness. And I didn't have health insurance until I was in college and there was a group plan that I could enroll in. I felt that this was so unfair, especially to the parents and grandparents out there who worry about the health and well-being of their children, but also worry about the fact that an injury or an illness could lead them into medical bankruptcy. And so it's been an issue that I feel passionately about. And I thought it was so important when we fought for and won the reform in the Affordable Care Act that says insurance companies can't reject you because you have a pre-existing health condition. They must cover you, and that coverage must be affordable and comprehensive. And these hard-fought and won reforms are being torn back by Trump Care. It really puts insurance companies back in charge and lets them raise deductibles and charge higher premiums. And a lot of other harmful things are contained in Trump Care.
Now, when we say torn back, especially when we're talking about children with pre-existing conditions, what kind of rights are being sort of stripped in the Trump Care plan?
Right. So the President Trump and the Republicans will try to tell you that pre-existing conditions are still covered under their plan. However, they have written in a lot of provisions that make that far from a certainty. And let me explain. If there's an interruption in somebody's health insurance, so if they have a pre-existing condition and then there's an interruption in their paying the premiums for their health care, they actually can be rejected, and certainly this frees up insurance companies to charge higher premiums and higher deductibles for people with pre-existing conditions. So if you say they're guaranteed access, but they can't afford it, is that truly a guarantee?
Yeah. You've been particularly concerned about seniors. What about this health care bill makes them so vulnerable?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that people who are in their 50s and early 60s necessarily even think of themselves as seniors, but middle-aged and older Americans who are not yet eligible for Medicare face very, very sizable increases in their premiums and deductibles. The Affordable Care Act had some guarantees that prevented people being charged excessive amounts due to just their age. This pulls those back, that loosens those restrictions, and now people 50 and older are going to be able to be charged much higher premiums and deductibles. So this is a big concern. Also, the entire plan hastens the insolvency of Medicare. And that is, again, a big concern as seniors, people 65 and older, rely on Medicare for needed health care services.
So we're looking at estimates right now from the Congressional Budget Office saying that around 14 million will lose their coverage in the first year, with an additional 10 million losing coverage over the next decade. Do we know what those numbers look like for Wisconsin? How is Trump Care going to impact specifically Wisconsinites?
Well, we can certainly do some extrapolation from the national figures that the Congressional Budget Office came up with yesterday. But what I will say is this is heartbreaking to think about the fact that we have made so much progress in reducing the level of uninsurance in our nation. And the Congressional Budget Office estimates that if Trump Care passes, we will almost double the number of uninsured, the percentage of uninsured in our country. And so we can, I think, extrapolate the same for the state of Wisconsin. And in the days to come, I think we'll have more specific information about how it will impact people in our state. But just know that the news is really dire for those who have struggled to afford insurance coverage. And I can tell you that the people of Wisconsin did not send me to Washington to take away people's health care. And I won't support repealing the guaranteed health insurance protections and care that people have today. So I am strenuously opposing this Trump Care plan.
You know, what do you say to some Republicans, like your former colleague in the House, Paul Ryan, who believe this bill will really encourage people to take ownership of their health care?
You know, today people must take ownership of their health care. There is definitely a commitment that each individual and family needs to make. But before the passage of the Affordable Care Act, insurance was often totally out of reach in terms of cost or denied individuals altogether because of pre-existing health conditions that they might have had. And so we have come so far in granting affordable access to quality coverage through the passage of the Affordable Care Act. I would be the first to say it wasn't perfect and needed to be strengthened, but repealing it and with this wholly inadequate Trump Care replacement is not the direction to go.
There are some politicians who seem to have taken issue with the different things that have to be included in these affordable health care plans. And they kind of want to go to a more a la carte version of health care. What would that mean for people with pre-existing conditions, people who are sick?
It runs completely counter to the whole idea and concept of insurance to begin with. The idea with insurance is that we all put in against the risk that any one of us might get sick with an illness that requires care and treatment that might be expensive or that we might be injured and need to seek emergency medical care and follow-up care. And it requires that the healthy put into that insurance pool, just like those who have pre-existing conditions. The more you take the healthy out of the pool, the insurance pool, the care and insurance coverage for those who are, have chronic conditions, who are older, et cetera, become exorbitant and unaffordable. And remember, if we don't have people with health insurance, it does ultimately come back to the taxpayers. I mean, I remember what we had prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the protections embodied therein. People who were ill without insurance often put off care until things were pretty bad and then would often present in hospital emergency rooms. They wouldn't be denied care. But those costs then went to the taxpayers. And we don't want to recreate that situation of really, a catastrophic care system. We want to encourage people to, have annual wellness checks and to be proactive about maintaining their good health.
Well, Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect and taking the time to talk with me.
Well, I'm delighted to, and I hope your listeners will continue to follow this debate closely. It's going to impact everybody. Healthcare is a deeply personal issue, and I hope your listeners speak out as they learn more.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Democrat Tammy Baldwin is the junior senator from Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, who reached her in Washington, D.C.
The debate over high-capacity wells is playing out today in Madison. That story when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. A public hearing is underway right now at the state capitol in Madison. Its subject is high-capacity wells, which increasingly fuel water-intensive operations in Wisconsin, including farm fields, animal feedlots, and frac sand mine operations.
Each well can extract more than 100,000 gallons of water per day. The proposed law eases the regulations regarding these wells, and right now, if someone wants to construct or operate a high-capacity well, the DNR must approve.
The bill would eliminate that provision. Issue groups including the Dairy Business Association and the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers Association applaud the proposal, but Bob Clark is among its critics.
He heads the Friends of Central Sands. Clark says rivers and lakes are being affected by the aggregate impact of large wells within sensitive watersheds. He shared his read of the bill with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.
It grandfathers all existing wells, which includes all their existing environmental problems, and those will be held in place in perpetuity. That is one significant problem we have with this bill, and there are a few others as well.
So when you say environmental problems, what are you saying?
Well, for example, if, and it has been shown that some of the wells have been pumping so high, and the cumulative effects, which of course, if you remember the case, case that we took to the courts where we won, and Judge Bolt ruled that you must consider cumulative effects, will not be considered here. Attorney General Brad Schimmel had the opinion that the DNR did not have the authority to do that, and this bill basically codifies that opinion. So if there are wells that are pumping too much water in combination with their neighbor wells, and lakes and streams and wetlands are affected, that environmental problem basically will be held in perpetuity. It will continue to occur. They will not be able to ever, and that's the biggest word, ever change those wells. So it will never improve the problem.
Your area has been studied for quite a long time. I mean, I'm sure there's still mysteries in the hydrology, but much has been studied. Is that correct?
Yeah, these studies go back several decades. And the most particular one that people talk about is the Little Plover River study. The Little Plover River that runs just south of Stevens Point, for example, has been studied a few times, and most recently it was studied again, and it has shown very specifically that the river actually runs dry at some times of the year because of the direct impact of the high-capacity wells. This bill talks about study areas, which sounds great. Unfortunately, a couple of very specific areas, for example, the Little Plover River, the area around Hancock Lake or Plainfield Lake, are not included in these study areas. But yet, the Little Plover River study has already shown that the high-capacity well has a negative impact, and it's yet totally being ignored in this study. Our lake, which is Pleasant Lake near Coloma, is in fact part of the study area, but it does not talk about the larger area around Pleasant Lake, which, of course, that's where the groundwater comes from in the whole watershed area. And these, you know, the problem with the study areas, it sounds great. Again, it's a great concept. They just don't factor in all the areas that actually need study. In fact, there is no guarantee that once the study is done and there's any recommendation, the legislator has to approve it. So the study could be dismissed, refuted, ignored. It doesn't really do anything other than sound good on paper. So again, it sounds like a very good bill on the surface, and it does, in fact, from a farming perspective and those that are pumping water, it does codify exactly status quo right now, but it really doesn't do the kinds of things that some of the words would imply that it does.
This is a statewide bill, but regions of our state have their particular hydrology and their soil compositions, and the Central Sands, it is just that. You're a very sandy zone, right?
Yeah, this is all the Leopold country, Sand County Almanac. That's exactly what it is. So water percolates to the groundwater fairly quickly, which is, you know, the blessing and curse in terms of perception. The assumption that many people have is when you irrigate ground, it goes right into the groundwater. And that's partially true. On one hand, what it does is takes the pollutants with it because of the sand. But also, it's not one for one. So when you water the crops, much of that water is held in the crops, and much of that water goes out through the leaves in evaporation. So a very small percentage actually goes into the ground to recharge the groundwater. So it is a blessing curse in terms of our sandy soil.
So in growing crops, traditional crops, that requires a lot of water.
Especially in the sand. And potatoes, which is in the central sands area, is a very heavy crop, is a very water-intensive crop. That's part of the challenge as well.
So has your group had the opportunity to speak with any of the authors of the bill?
There have been several attempts by individuals to speak to the authors. This, of course, is a bill that came up last year and has been slightly modified. So they are well aware and informed of our concerns. So there is no surprise in terms of how everyone feels about this. And again, this is not a matter of trying to take water away from farming, Susan. That is absolutely not the case. But there's got to be some balance. There has to be some looking at both sides, if you will. As George Kraft likes to say, there's got to be somebody doing the math. You can't take out more than what goes in, and that's just not sustainable.
And George Kraft is a scientist who's done a lot of the study that you've talked about.
Correct, yes, UW Stevens Point, hydrologist.
Very sort of naive question, but hope springs eternal. Is there ever the opportunity for farmers and individuals, groups such as yours, to sit down at a table, or does that just not happen?
You know, there have been actually several attempts to do that, both from the Wisconsin Potato Vegetable Growers Association as well as a consortium of individual groups and individuals like ourselves. From personal opinion, I think that there really could be an opportunity to do that, and it should be. Again, everyone on both sides are pretty reasonable folks. But there are those that really, on both sides of any debate, there are those that are pretty entrenched in their area. And somewhere in the middle is the right answer. And I think there is an opportunity. I would love to see an opportunity for the groups to come together to create some of this certainty on their end, if you will, to some degree, as well as certainty from our end, that the property that I purchased on a lake, that the lake will, in fact, still be there. And people don't believe that happens, but there are lakes in the Central Sands that are literally dried up and are a few feet deep when they used to be many feet deep. And those things are, in fact, happening. And unfortunately, unless you drive by it, many people just don't believe it.
Is there an element of this bill that we haven't touched on that you feel needs to be explained?
There is a provision in the bill that nobody really understands why. It allows the lake districts to install a high-capacity well for no charge to support a study around the area. But that, again, it doesn't really mean anything. So we're gonna put more wells around the lake so we can study the problem of the lake when there's no ramification of the study at all. So we don't really understand the purpose of that being inserted into the bill.
Bob Clark is board president of the Friends of the Central Sands. He spoke with Susan Bentz about a bill that, at this moment, is being considered by the Senate Committee on Labor and Regulatory Reform in Madison. The public hearing is underway right now. You can hear WUWM's full coverage of the debate tomorrow during Morning Edition.
Milwaukee Magazine convenes a conversation between 8 chefs around the city. We'll hear about what they discussed when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Later today, the winners of the annual James Beard Awards will be announced, honoring chefs from around the country. 3 Milwaukee chefs are among the semifinalists for the Best Chef Award for the Midwest: Justin Carlisle, Thomas Hawk, and Karen Bell.
Coincidentally, all 3 of those were among the 8 Milwaukee area chefs who participated in a wide-ranging roundtable discussion that comprises the cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Senior editor and dining critic Ann Christensen wrote that story and is here to share it. Hi, Ann. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
All right. So let me ask this. This is the first thing that jumped out at me, because your name is on this article as an author. This is a round table with 8 different chefs. You are the dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. And so, as I recall, you go to some great lengths to keep your identity hidden.
Right.
How did you pull this off?
Yeah, you're thinking, what is she sitting at the table with these eight people? Well, no, I'm not. I was on speakerphone. So I set it up, and the eight chefs that we chose for this to sit down and talk about dining topics, we had them meet at kind of a out-of-the-way location, something not in one of their restaurants, mm-hmm. which would be, you know, maybe a little odd for them.
Right. Not in an Applebee's.
No. And then we wanted our photographer there, too. And we had to have our whole art staff because they're art directing everything. So our editor, Carol, was the moderator. But beforehand, Carol and I had come up with all these questions we wanted to ask and to engage them in conversation. So, no, I was not there, but I was on speakerphone. And there were lots of little mini tape recorders, including my own, going.
And Carol was kind of your proxy, in a way.
She was my proxy. Yes, my proxy.
Well, and this has got to be kind of an uncommon experience for someone in your position to be able to ask these people these kind of candid questions and, you know, not worry about them knowing whether you're there or not.
Well, yes, that's true. But at the same time, I wished I had a cam, because in some cases I really was wondering what their body language or their facial expressions were like when they were answering certain questions, or if there was some tension, you know, between certain people. I don't know. I mean,
there are a lot of smiles in the pictures.
Yeah, right. Obviously. But, you know, I mean, some of the chefs are more outgoing. Some are shyer. I mean, they're not used to this sort of attention, and they're used to being in the kitchen. But it was fun, though, I have to say. And, you know, to ask these questions and really kind of find out how much they were, you know, willing to get into it, or, you know, maybe be a little more tactful or diplomatic in the way that they answered a question. But it was all really interesting. And we want to do it again. And I think maybe next time we should get them loosened up with a bottle of scotch or something.
Well, and these people are in a really competitive field. How often do they actually see each other at all?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we wanted to put together so we really, given the dynamics of the group setting, and also just the idea of photographing eight people that we knew that we wanted to put on the cover, we pretty much determined that eight people was our limit. We couldn't go beyond that, even though there are lots of chefs that we would love to have gotten into this group. We also wanted a mix, you know, and obviously we want women's voices. We want minority voices. We want all different kinds of people. It turned out that two people that are on the chef's table are nominated for Beard Awards, James Beard Awards this year. One is a winner. So it was interesting coming up with who was actually going to be in this group of chefs, and then coming up with these questions was a pretty interesting, you know, idea, because, you know, the certain things seemed like very like no brainers, like, you know, what do you think about farm to table?
Right, exactly.
Come on, you know, are you sick of that term? What does it mean? And then there are obviously chefs that just say, well, that's just the way things are, have been and should be. There just is a term for it, you know, and that happens to be something that the public just jumps all over, you know. And, you know, they certainly had things to say about diners and about the increase in knowledge or the, you know, people thinking they have, diners thinking they have more knowledge and coming in with that knowledge and how they behave. That was an interesting offshoot.
Well, and one of the things that struck me was, I think, I can't remember who said it actually, but their attitude towards reviews, which kind of, you know, gets at this whole issue. Some, and maybe most, say they either don't read them or don't read them closely, mm-hmm. or don't pay a lot of attention. As a restaurant reviewer, how would you hope that these chefs take, you know, the business of reviews? And, you know, did it surprise you to hear what they said?
Well, first of all, the way the question was framed, it was all reviews by all
right.
media. But it was interesting how it was changed right away to become Yelp reviews, because that was something that they have very strong feelings about. And people that go onto Yelp are anyone, any diner. Or not a diner, anyone. So they could, you know, be someone who just has an axe to grind or someone with a valid complaint, you know. If someone has a valid, I hope they're reading, you know, reviews in the media where there's actually a qualified critic going in and evaluating and hopefully offering some constructive criticism. I don't know that that's necessarily the case in Yelp. And I can see why they would ignore that because—
right. Crowdsource reviews often come down to, you know, I didn't like this food, therefore it is not good.
Right, right. And in fact, I just recently saw a Yelp review by someone who said, well, I only went to this place once and I had one thing, but Yelp really wants me to review this. So I'm going to just say I didn't like this thing, but I only had one thing. But Yelp wants us to review out, so I'm giving you one star. Well, how valid is that?
Right.
That's a good example of the type of thing out there. And I can see why that can be very hurtful, too, and very and get them upset, you know?
I think it was Justin Carlisle who says at one point, and I am paraphrasing here, that cuisine is becoming less important than who the team is that's preparing the food. Do you see that?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's a really interesting point because, you know, a lot of restaurants, and I definitely do it. We have a list of restaurants, and we want to be able to label a restaurant. Is it New American? Is it Italian? Is it eclectic gastropub? I recently saw a term, Asian gastropub. I had never seen that before. And chefs are often very reluctant to label their cuisine because it's so much of a mix of things. And really, it's them. And I think you're finding, and some points were raised, that you go to this restaurant for this person's food, this chef's food, that chef's food, Justin's food, the other Justin Abrahamian, yeah, from Stanford, his food, Thomas Hauck from circa 1880, and Karl Rasch's. Karl Rasch's may be a German restaurant, but I think you're finding people that are going there now because they're going for Thomas's food. So I think it's a really interesting point, and yes, absolutely, it's happening. That is a very valid point now.
Would you make the case that that's primarily happening at the higher end of the equation?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that you can say that about, you know, Chinese restaurants or, you know, a lot of Thai restaurants, some maybe, but, you know, or just a burger place. Not really. I would say more fine dining, higher end restaurants. Yeah, good point.
And speaking of burgers and speaking of fine dining, the question came up whether old fashioned fine dining is making a comeback. And what was the consensus there?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, from some of these chefs, I think Thomas Hauck was the one that even mentioned. He mentioned a restaurant from the past called Frenchie's, which, unless you've been around a long time, you wouldn't remember it, but it was a really odd place, funny little place near where Beans and Barley is now. You know, you could get, you know, a New York strip for like, you know, I don't know, $1.50 or something like that. But there was a certain mystique to going there, and you had to wear a jacket. And that there's a nostalgia, and maybe it's a madman thing, but there's a nostalgia for that time of going back and dressing up a little bit. And, you know, having this particular drink in your hand, those old-fashioned cocktails, there's a nostalgia for that. And I think the point was raised that maybe something like that could work again, but not in the same way, in a more modernized way.
Right. And there's a nostalgia, but if you're going to pay, I think Thomas makes the point, if you're going to pay $23 for a cheeseburger, your expectations from it are different than if you pay $8 for one.
Right. But, you know, I really think that term fine dining, you know, it's a very different. It's a term that applies to, I think, to small plates. You can go to a small plate restaurant, a certain type of small plate restaurant, order three plates, and you're getting into that same three, four plates. You're getting that same price range as a fine dining restaurant. That is just getting to be such a loose term now that I think it can apply to so many things.
These are eight diverse people, but how do they see the Midwest being part of who they are and what they're preparing?
You know, every one of them, I think, looks at the Midwest and how it affects their food. I mean, a really good example would be Karen Bell, who owns Bavette, butcher shop in the Third Ward. It's a restaurant as well. And, you know, the meats that she has there, most of them are coming from Wisconsin. You know, I mean, everyone is looking at sourcing, local sourcing is so important. It's same as this farm to table idea and the idea of seasonality, and the closer it you get it, the better that is for everyone concerned, the farmer, for the restaurant operator. You know, everybody's making a wage that they can sustain themselves. I don't think there is one chef on this list that wouldn't say, you know, it's good for everybody. And plus, why not support our state or the Midwest? And that cuisine, you know, it's maybe kind of a, I mean, how does one describe it? You know, I mean, it's partly the ingredients that are coming from here. It's maybe that homey type of thing. Maybe it's some of these things that people think of as, you know, steak tartare, things that are maybe a little more popular in the Midwest than elsewhere. It's still kind of a maybe not a very fully defined term, but I think all of them identify with it.
Did you get a sense for how people in, you know, the chefs treat experimentation in a place like Milwaukee versus, you know, if they were plying their trade in New York or mm-hmm. Los Angeles or San Francisco or whatever?
I think it's you know, it's definitely mixed depending on who you talk to. You know, Justin from Sanford, it was pretty interesting. He worked under Sandy D'Amato. Obviously, Sandy owned Sanford before he sold it to Justin. And Sandy's take on trends, you know, and all these trends that they cycle through. They come through, they pass through, they come back again. And that's just the nature of trends. And some people are going to say, you know, I'm going to just do what I do and I'm not going to look at the trends and I'm going to ignore it. And then others are going to say, no, I want to try that. I'm seeing it in other cities. It's really cool. Let's see if I can do it here, but in a fashion that I think as a special or in some way that isn't going to like break the bank for me. So I think there's some, you know, it's definitely different rules of thought on it.
I wonder if there's just not a critical mass of diners in Wisconsin that's willing to go out on a limb and try something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it's interesting. I have, you know, friends, and I'm going to be going to New York soon. I mean, you're going to see things in New York that are probably they're never going to come here, or they're going to come here 5 years from. 5 years from now, you know, and something's just because Milwaukee is a town that I think in some ways is sort of impervious to trends. People just don't care as much.
Well, and in a way, I wonder if that's part of the point of a New York or a San Francisco, that these are the places that, you know, that they're good test markets. And the ones that make it through New York can make it to Milwaukee.
Maybe that could be.
I feel like I just gave Milwaukee a backhanded compliment.
I was kind of wondering how to respond to that, but I know that you didn't. You meant that as a as a compliment.
The cream rises to the top, and Milwaukee, you know, we're the cream city.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well put.
This had to be a real eye opener for someone in your business.
Well, it was in the sense of, you know, I don't ask a lot of these questions. I might ask a few of these questions to one person at one time in a phone call because I'm talking to them on the phone, not in person. But to have them all together, or eight together, and, you know, maybe somebody's riffing off someone else or feeling like, oh, this person opened the door to this. I'm going to keep that going. Kind of like that topic of the debauchery of restaurants. And when we say debauchery, it's not as debaucherous as you think. It's sort of that idea of, you know, drinking after hours and, you know, whatever, maybe loose talk in the kitchen, that sort of thing.
The fun that goes along
with it. The fun, right. I guess some of these questions are just not things that I ask on a regular basis, so sure. But it also made me realize that I want to do this again with another set of chefs.
All right. We'll be looking for it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. She wrote the article based on a roundtable conversation the magazine facilitated with eight Milwaukee chefs. It is the cover story in the March issue.
One last break and then a preview of the Florentine Opera's production of Don Giovanni, which is on stage this weekend. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Mozart's Don Giovanni, the Don Juan story, is one of the great operas in the Western canon. Glorious music, an intricate plot, and a very satisfying ending have attracted audiences since its premiere in 1787.
The Florentine Opera is reprising its 2006 production this weekend with performances on Friday and Sunday. British-Canadian baritone Alexander Dobson sings the role of the Don. South African bass baritone Musa Nukwan Juana sings the role of the servant Leporello, and bass David Lee sings the role of Commendatore. And they join me in the studio now. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
I have to say, Don Giovanni is one of my favorite operas. I'm in love with all the Mozart operas, but I particularly love this one because the hero is kind of an anti-hero. He's not a very nice guy, but boy, is he fun. And how do you feel playing him? This is not your first time with this character.
It's not my first time with this character or this opera. I have played also Mazzetto and Leporello. Next will be the Commendatore.
Doing them all.
But he is, like you say, the anti-hero. We want to really like this guy, even though he's deplorable. Everything he does by raping women, by treating his servant with such disrespect, beating him, calling him names constantly, he's not a very nice guy, but we still feel sympathetic towards him. So there is this dichotomy that Mozart did create, well, De Ponte did create.
Well, Mozart did too, I think, with the music, because he's got this gorgeous music to sing. And again, he's just not very nice.
No, he's not.
He's singing about really kind of ugly things.
Yes, but he does it in such a way. He constantly is lying as well. So he has crafted the skill of how to bring people with him on his journeys that he wants to go on, especially women. And his servant Leporello does tell Don Elvira how many women he has been with. I won't give it away, but...
No, it's many, and that is one of the most famous arias that you have to sing, is that wonderful list aria.
That's the thing about this, because it's supposed to be comedy, so he's making fun of her, but on the other hand, he's tormenting her. You know, it's not nice, because he says, you're not the first, you're not the last. Yeah, so you're not that important, just get over yourself. But then how do you say that to someone who's such tormented and yet the music is beautiful and playful? Also, another interesting part about Leporello is also in a dilemma because in the beginning of the opera, he says, I want to be a gentleman. You know, I'm tired of working for him, sleeping badly, eating badly, being treated like this. But then there's this love-hate relationship between the two of them. It's like, why doesn't he leave him? Because he kind of likes that life. So there's something and sinister about Leporello too. It's just that if only the Don would treat him better, then they'll be in some kind of an equal footing, even though it's master and servant. Just treat me better, then the two of us will be horrible people, but just treat me better.
I'll be better with it, you know.
And so it's very interesting.
Do you think Leporello wants to be Don Giovanni on some level?
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
I mean, voglio fare gentiluomo. I want to be a gentleman. But gentleman in this case just doesn't mean just gentlemen. It means in this context, I want to be a master like him. I want to be a libertine and have money and all that. Leporello is about money. In the second act, when he says, I'm leaving you, I'm done with you, I almost got killed because of you, the Don gives him money. He's like, okay, just this one last time. So Leporello is like so used to this money because I think he may have worked for a number of other people before, but then the kind of money he gets from the Don is so different. Mm. So, you know, this abusive relationship, like women are abused to so hard now to live this life because you've gotten used to it. But it's just that, you know, this guy has so much money. So you're like, even though he abuses me, if I leave him, who else is going to give me this same kind of money? It's very interesting, isn't it?
Right, I bet it is, to try to figure that character out.
And the Don himself, he couldn't live without Leporello. And he calls him his friend. There's a few times where he says, friend, come here. So he does feel that Leporello is his friend and his only friend because he has betrayed so many people, men and women. The only person he does have is Leporello. And if he ever lost Leporello, he would not be the Don.
But yet it's all about money, too. I mean, that, as Musa was saying, this relationship, you're paying him to be your friend.
Yes.
Which is really kind of pathetic.
Because he has no one in his life.
Yeah. Right.
And, right. I mean, Leporello holds all the secrets. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think Leporello is now on the verge of leaving him because the killing of the Commendatore, you know, that's you can kill servants all you like or peasants, which he might have done before or abuse women, but to kill someone of his equal rank, this is new even for Leporello or for other characters like Don Ottavio, who even sings an aria, say, hey, you've done all sorts of things, but to kill your fellow Dons, aristocrats, now you've gone too far.
Mm. And, well, David, let's bring you in because you are the Commendatore. And so you don't have a lot of time on stage, but what you do have is really intense.
Yeah. Well, and it's some of the most famous music in the history of opera. I mean, it's really, it's incredibly iconic music.
And so as you're listening to the, I'm sure you guys have all been talking about this in rehearsal and you've done this before, but do you think he decides he's going to have the revenge?
You mean as he's dying?
Right.
I think there's some question about that. I think for sure as he's dying, I think there's a recognition of what Giovanni has done and a recognition of the righteousness of his anger. And I think that that righteousness manifests 2.5 hours later when he comes back, you know, but I'm not sure that the plan is fully there. You know, there's a lot made by musicologists and whatever, the fact that Giovanni never succeeds in any of his conquests in the course of this, like, 3.5 hour opera, that he's just thwarted time and again. And there's an argument to be made that the Commendatore is sort of thwarting him from beyond the grave. I'm not sure how much I buy into that, but for sure he is trying. You know, I think he has the immediate thought of, if I could do anything to mess with this guy, I would love to.
Well, and that is true. You don't actually succeed.
No.
You are thwarted. But the implication is that you have succeeded many, many times in the past.
Yes. And even as the opera's going, I keep making references to things I've done off stage, but nothing is actually seen on stage.
This is an iconic, it's part of the opera repertoire around the world. Are there ways that you try to embody these characters that are so well known and make them your own?
Well, I think, especially for the Don, it is that struggle of how to make him human. So how to make him, we don't want him to be likable, but as you said at the beginning, he is the anti-hero. So there is that hero aspect. We are, as an audience member, are we rooting for him? Do we want him to succeed? Do we want him to be punished? Like, how do we feel about this person? And portraying that person, how do I want him to be perceived? Do I want him to be likable? Do I want him to be hated? I know there was a production at the Met this year and they criticized the singer who was playing the Don because he had made him so unlikable. So that there
he
was
he went too far the other
exactly,
way.
Exactly. So there was no sympathy for him. So it is that tricky balance.
I think it's one of those things where an audience member has to almost like the Don in spite of their own misgivings.
Exactly.
It's like it's that tension. The audience has to be kind of on like, well, God, he's such a bad person, but I kind of like him.
Mm-hmm. So charming.
Yeah. So charming. And, you know, he'd be great to have dinner with.
Yeah.
You know. Do you think Mozart and De Ponte were trying to keep us on that edge? Does he ever resolve it, do you think? Do we ever know definitively who this guy is by the end?
No. Because even at the end, he says he won't give in. He won't give in to the Commendatore. He won't change his ways. That's why he is dragged to hell. He is so stubborn in his choice of his life that he's living that he will not change.
You know, one of the things I've always wondered at the end of the opera, what happens to you, Musso? What happens to Leporello? Does he take over?
No, interesting enough, because I don't think Don has left any money for Leporello or put him in the estate, because this is a Diovado all'osteria, a trovare padro mio. So I'm going to go to the pub, if you like, and find a new master. So that's it for Leporello. You know, it's interesting. He's been getting all this money and all that, but I don't think he's been saving anything. They just, like, spend and do that. But they've never discussed that, you know. And then one wonders how long they've been together. They might have been together for a long time. Yeah. But it's like all these rappers or pop singers being signed onto record labels, and they get all these big houses and all that. But you only find out at the end of the day when the career just, like, dwindles down that they didn't own anything. But if they die, you know, before time, and then people have to discuss what went wrong. They're like, what about all the record sales you did? It's like, hey, you didn't own any of those. That was a record company. So I think it's some kind of a similar situation here. Also, Leporello is interesting enough because at the end of the opera, he begs him, he's like, don't take his hand. If it were up to Leporello, the two of us would escape and live another day, right? It might be because he cares for him or partly because he just cares about getting his money because he sees that if this guy dies, then it's over for him. Also, another interesting part about this opera is the first time in opera history where any composer had written for three male voices, low voices, mm-hmm. to sing together at once yeah. in the beginning of the opera, where each and every person is talking on their own. Whoa, yeah. what is this? You know, and it's beautiful music, but each and every person is having their own voices talking about what's actually going on their minds. And then at the end of the opera, when he's being taken to hell, yeah. that's just like mind-blowing in terms of opera history. And one wonders what was going on in, you know, Da Pontes and Mozart's brain. Yeah. I think there's so much to still figure out about this opera, which is not resolved. Also, I mean, the end of the day, when the Don has gone to hell, everyone comes back, Don Ottavio, Anna, and Elvira. They say, well, to the audience, if you behave like him, then you'll go to hell like him. But then, you know, there's a twist which I'm not going to spoil, which you're going to see here. Because at the end of the day, you know, bad men don't actually suffer as they ought to. Maybe in Mozart's time they might have, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. I think he was saying that it might not be. And when we're saying low voices, we're talking baritone, bass baritone, and bass, right?
Yeah. Well, the original singers in Prague, where this was commissioned, so they had three basses in the house.
Yeah.
So the Commendatore and Mazzetto were actually sung by the same singer because they're never on the stage at the same time. But our production, they're obviously
two separate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So these were the singers in the house that he had to write it for. So it's incredible that he chose to use the three low voices,
yeah,
like Musa says, at the beginning and the end.
British-Canadian baritone Alexander Dobson sings the role of the Don. South African bass baritone Musa Ngwana sings the role of the servant Leporello. And the bass David Lee sings the role of Commendatore in the Florentine opera production of Don Giovanni. It's on stage this Friday and Sunday at the Marcus Center's Eline Hall, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.